According to the Bush White House and the captured press, everything is going great in Iraq. In November of 2007, U.S. casualties in Iraq settled toward record lows. Mainstream American media reported the surge was working and Iraqis were going home. But one of the few independent Western journalists reporting from that country tells us, watch out for this propaganda. America is arming, paying, and training its enemies to give the illusion of success in a country of utter failure. And some people are returning home because they have no other choice. Dar Jamal was speaking in Vancouver, Canada, December 8th, giving an update and promoting his new book, Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, published by Haymarket Books. The foreword is by Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Outraged by the mainstream media's push for war in Iraq, Jamal left Anchorage, Alaska, his home, and moved to Baghdad. His reports from the front lines, as one of the few unembedded journalists from the West, have been published by the BBC, Pacifica Radio, the Asia Times, in fact, in most countries outside of the United States. Dar Jamal writes regularly for IPS, the Interpress Service. Here is Dar Jamal.
To talk about Iraq, I basically want to do a few things. One, talk about very briefly why I did decide to go, and then talk about what's happening on the ground right now in Iraq, because specifically at this time, we're in the midst of a pretty amazing propaganda campaign that is basically telling people, yeah, things are better in Iraq. Things are better. Even people are coming back to their homes in Baghdad and this sort of thing. And so I want to go into some greater detail about what specifically is happening on the ground in Iraq today and why the situation is where it is exactly. And I want to read a little bit from the book. I promise not to read to you too much, and I'll definitely be doing more talking. But especially with this audience, if I won't spend a lot of time talking about why the U.S. invaded Iraq. I imagine the common denominator in this audience is high enough that I don't need to spend too much time on that, particularly in light of the fact that we have this interesting phenomena happening in the United States today that generals, high-ranking generals, very high-ranking generals that are now retiring, and I think there's about 7 or 8 now that have retired. It's kind of almost become like a trend or this kind of fatty thing to do for these high-ranking generals to retire and then become critical of the war or how the invasion was run or how the occupation is being run or of the Bush administration itself, as Ricardo Sanchez was doing just a couple of months ago. And it's interesting because these generals retire and then all of a sudden this phenomena happens and their testicles drop. And then they start lashing out, and they find this courage, and they start lashing out at the administration. And I always ask myself, well, if you really believe that so much, then why did you keep doing what you were doing before you retired? But anyway, that aside, the latest addition to the newfound testicle club is former CENTCOM Commander General John Abizaid. He's now part of the Hoover Institute, otherwise known as a very conservative think tank. It's Stanford University. It's also referred to as Bush's brain trust. And so, big shocker, John Abizaid has a gig with Hoover Institute now. And he was speaking there at Stanford the middle of this past October about the Iraq War. And he said, quote, for anyone who's still in doubt what this war was about, of course it's about oil. We can't really deny that. We've treated the Arab world as a collection of big gas stations. Our message to them is, guys, keep your pumps open, prices low, be nice to the Israelis, and you can do whatever you want out back. And then a little bit later, on October 31st, when he was speaking at Carnegie Mellon University, Abizaid told the audience that it may well be 50 years before the United States leaves the Middle East, in case there's any doubt. But I do want to back up and take us back to really the launching of the PR campaign to sell the Iraq War idea to the American public and to the rest of the world. And I want to take us back to September 6, 2002 to do this, because it was on that day that the then White House Chief of Staff, Andrew Card, when speaking about the PR campaign for the Iraq War, told reporters in public, quote, from a marketing point of view, you don't introduce new products in August. I didn't, with few exceptions, I didn't see much mainstream media ire raised about this statement at all. I mean, a White House chief of staff talking about a PR campaign and war in the same sentence. But launch a PR campaign for war is exactly what he did, because literally on the very next day, on September 7th, 2002, George Bush and Tony Blair stood together at Camp David and declared that they had evidence from a United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency report that showed that Iraq was 6 months away from building nuclear weapons. The problem was, no such IAEA report ever existed. But we know that. But now I want to play a little trick. Just let's suspend reality for a moment and pretend that we had legitimate journalism in the establishment media. And we're back at September 7, 2002. So just pretend that all of the big newspapers, all of the big TV stations have legitimate journalists really doing their job, really digging for the facts, really holding the centers of power to account for the claims that they make and the things that they do, and that Bush and Blair make this outrageous statement claiming they have evidence from a UN IAEA report that actually doesn't exist. So in this world of legitimate journalism, we would assume then the next day, for example, perhaps the most reputable newspaper in the United States, the New York Times, certainly the most prestigious, that the front page story should have been, the lead story should have been something like, Bush and Blair cite a report as evidence that actually doesn't exist. Something along these lines should have been the story, because I, as a mountain climber in Anchorage, Alaska, using the internet to read UN weapons inspectors' reports, Le Monde Diplomatique, The Independent, The Guardian, basically anything except U.S. mainstream media news, I knew when they said that it was bogus. And I would imagine that most of you in this room probably knew that too. But nevertheless, the very next day, so let's go back to reality. No legitimate journalism, with few exceptions, in the establishment media. And the very next day, on September 8, 2002, the lead story in the New York Times, co-authored by none other than Judith Miller and Michael Gordon of WMD Notoriety. Michael Gordon, of course, still writing for the Times. And they proudly quoted their favorite source, anonymous Bush administration officials, as saying, quote, Iraq has stepped up its quest for nuclear weapons and has embarked on a worldwide hunt for materials to make an atomic bomb. And a little bit more about the way this propaganda system worked, and this has all come out now. This is not me breaking any new information. It's very well known, especially at least in journalism circles. But the way that this worked, for example, Judith Miller, very prominent journalist with the New York Times, has security clearance at the Pentagon. She's regularly going into the Pentagon, being fed this information by her anonymous Bush administration officials. She's coming back to the Times, writing this up. The story runs on September 8. On literally the same day, Cheney goes on national television claiming Iraq is 6 months away from getting nuclear weapons. Look, even the New York Times is reporting this. And so it went over and over and over for months and months and months. And watching that happen before my very eyes, that for me was my red line. That's when my red line got crossed. I was completely outraged at what I was seeing and felt that the stakes had to be upped a bit if anything was going to change. And so that was when my red line got crossed and I decided to go to Iraq. And I would argue that the coverage is horrible. I mean, that's not journalism. That's what veteran journalist John Pilger describes as propaganda disguised as journalism. That's what that is. And I would argue that that trend has continued. It has not abated. Some people think maybe, well, it has abated because, you know, we are getting some idea from the mainstream media now that things are actually a little bit better in Iraq, or they are going bad and there isn't enough reconstruction and there are problems. But when we compare the catastrophic nature of the situation on the ground in Iraq today to the type of coverage it's getting, particularly right now, it's literally like you're watching two different stories. So, for example, if we, as I touched on earlier, if we look at the corporate media today and we look at how Iraq is being reported, and I assume that this is fairly similar in Canada, things are better. U.S. troop deaths are down to very, very low levels. People are returning to their homes in Baghdad. New breath is being brought into Baghdad. Baghdad's coming back to life. These are literally some of the headlines that have been in the New York Times and the Washington Post in recent weeks, and many of the other big papers around the U.S., the L.A. Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, Chicago Tribune. We can go down a long list. But again, it's an interesting methodology of propaganda because it focuses in on a few things that are true. Like, there are bits of truth in this. It's unarguable. U.S. troop deaths are down quite significantly. And this month, right now, we're on a trend where they may be the lowest of maybe even the entire occupation. And the fact is that, yes, there are some Iraqis who have returned to their homes in Baghdad. But let me just take these two facts that are being presented as evidence that the surge is working. These are the two primary arguments being made, at least in the United States media. So troop deaths are down. Now let's give a little backstory to that. Troop deaths are down. Why? One reason. Muqtada al-Sadr's militia, the Mahdi Army, which is the largest militia in the country, is on stand down right now. They're reorganizing, they're retooling, they've had some internal problems, so he literally has them, they have ceased all operations. So that's one reason why U.S. troop deaths are down. Another reason is that the primary resistance, which is largely Sunni, is also on stand down right now. They're, you know, in classic guerrilla war, you don't go head-to-head with the most powerful military on the planet when you're basically guys running around with Kalashnikovs and RPGs and you can plant roadside bombs. When that conventional military is making a huge offensive in one area of the country, you sit back and wait. After all, it's your country. It doesn't cost you anything to be there. You have more time. You basically have to not leave your country to win. So you're going to sit there and wait that out. And that's exactly what most of the resistance is doing today. Another important factor as to why U.S. troop deaths are down is because we have a policy that's being carried out in Al-Anbar province and part the Sunni-dominated parts of Baghdad, where the U.S. is doing on a huge scale what they did in Fallujah after the failed April 2004 siege. When the U.S. military tried to take Fallujah in April and they failed, they were kept out of the city by the resistance, they had to save face. Because 2004, we had a presidential election coming up that fall. We're already in the spring, and the military basically had a humiliating defeat handed to them. And it was also made very clear, look, if they're going to take Fallujah, it's going to cost a lot. It's going to cost a lot of American lives. There's going to be a tremendous amount of destruction in the city and probably a lot of civilian lives. So we need to find a way to put a smiley face on this, at least until after the election. And they did, and it was successful, in quotes. Because what they did is they bought off the resistance fighters in the city. They put them on the payroll. They started paying them monthly salaries. They started giving them guns and ammunition and flak jackets and radios and trucks. And they called them Iraqi police, and they called them Iraqi army. And Fallujah remained that way for 6 months. And the U.S. declared, we have handed security over to Fallujah. And that was on May 10th. I was in the city when they rolled the convoy into the city that day. Their little commander went in and met with the mayor, did the photo op, shake hands, and they left. So that was in April 04. And then we had the presidential so-called elections in the United States in 2004, in November 2004, 3 days after those elections, the second siege of Fallujah is launched and the city is completely destroyed. 70% of the city is destroyed.
You are listening to Dar Jamail, one of a half dozen independent Western journalists reporting from Iraq and the Middle East. Unlike all the major U.S. news reports, Jamail is not embedded or censored by the American Army. The speech was recorded in Vancouver, Canada on December 8, 2007 by Radio EcoShock.
So back to present day, we have in Al Anbar, it is the deadliest place in the country for U.S. soldiers. Second place is the province of Baghdad, but not by much. So these two most troublesome provinces for the U.S. military in Iraq, basically what they've decided to do is, again, buy off the fighters. So they found tribal sheikhs that are willing to collaborate with the Americans, and they've used them as point men to funnel, so far to date, over $17 million into monthly paychecks to Iraqi resistance fighters. They're paying them $300 a month, and before I tell you what they call them, and some of you probably have heard this because it's so outrageous, but a few of my friends and I were sitting in Baghdad at one point, and, you know, as a journalist, you hear these quotes coming out of high-ranking officials, and, you know, it's so outrageous. You're just, if you were writing a fiction novel, you'd be hard-pressed to make up more ridiculous types of quotes, and you know the ones I'm talking about. I mean, just listen to Bush for 5 minutes. But so we made this thing up called the Can't Make This Shit Up Club. And so the former resistance fighters that the U.S. is paying now to stand down and not attack them, they're calling them concerned local citizens. So that's definitely in the club. They're also called awakening forces, and then in other places they call them volunteers. It's also a recycling program of the Reagan strategy in Afghanistan in the 1980s of funneling in billions of dollars of arms and weapons, to Mujahideen there, except this time, back then, of course, they were fighting against the Soviet Union's military. Basically, Al Anbar province, it's also a classic divide-and-rule strategy, arming the Sunnis to the teeth while supporting the Shia politically in Baghdad. So these are some of the reasons why there's fewer U.S. troop fatalities, but I would argue confidently that it's a ticking time bomb and liable to explode in many, many different ways. The reason why there are actually some people going back to their homes in Baghdad, let's talk about that. First, let's put that in context. There's over 4.5 million people that are displaced from their homes, both inside and outside of Iraq. The number of, when we talk about a successful troop surge, this is what they're saying in the media in the United States, the surge is working. Well, the surge has worked. Since the surge started, the number of people displaced from their homes has quadrupled. And it's over 4.5 million now. And to date, the only legitimate figure I've seen produced by the UN of the number of Iraqis that have returned to their homes is 30,000. So 30,000 out of 4.5 million, but the surge is working. Let's talk about some of the reasons why they're going back. Up until October 1st, Syria was the only country on the planet that allowed Iraqis in without visa restrictions. As of October 1st, the country's buckling under the strain of refugees. Iraqis now compose 10% of the total population of Syria. So as of October 1st, the Syrian government imposed visa restrictions. So Iraqis wanting to come in have to either have a merchant visa, a way to prove that they're coming in to do business in the country, usually being invited by a business person in the country, or they have to have a medical visa. A medical visa showing that they are in need of urgent medical attention. Everyone else has to go back. So if you're an Iraqi and you come to the border and you can't prove that you deserve one of these visas or already have one, you get to choose between either staying at a refugee camp right on the border in the middle of the desert or going back to Baghdad and waiting it out in your home and hoping for the best. So and the second main reason that people are going back to their homes, and this is all backed up statistically by a recent poll conducted by UNHCR in Iraq, the second main reason is that literally people are running out of money. Because when you leave Iraq and you're a refugee, by law you're legally not allowed to work in the country that you go to. So if you're not able to find a black market job or have someone there that can support you or are rich enough or have enough money put away to support yourself, when your money runs out, what are you going to do? So you go back home. And that's why those are the two main reasons why these 30,000 people are going back. Less than 20% of those 30,000 people returning their homes are doing so because they want to. So just a couple of analyses that I could give of take the information being spewed by the corporate media about what's actually happening on the ground. And interesting things happen when you give context and when you give real facts about what's happening on the ground. But again, a little bit more overall context just to update you on the situation on the ground. I want to talk about the number of people killed in Iraq, but I want to start with a personal story to underscore why most of these deaths you never hear about and you never will. There's a man that I met in Bakuba. I talk about him in my book several times. His name's Sheikh Adnan. I met him when I was in there doing interviews at the very end of my first trip, actually. So this is back in January 2004. And then we became friends and stayed in touch. He's a Friday speaker at his mosque, a very religious man, an Islamic scholar at Baghdad University, and had actually written a book, a little book called Jesus and the Holy Quran, because he thought it'd be a good idea to try to have something to offer U.S. soldiers when they came into the country to show similarities between Islam and Christianity rather than the differences being harped on by the media. So this gives you an idea of the kind of guy that Sheikh Adnan is. And I'd come to Baghdad and be working, and he'd stop by my hotel after he'd gone to his classes at Baghdad University and or come in from Bakuba straight just to bring me home-cooked meals from his wife because he knew I was just eating like street kebabs all the time. And just a lovely guy. And then when it got too dangerous for me to keep going back into Iraq, he started coming out to Syria or Jordan to visit me. And this past summer when I was over in Syria reporting on the refugee situation, he came out to visit me again, and we spent time. And then I came home from the trip, and he had come out to visit me in Syria with a friend of his who also spoke good English. And a couple of months after I got home, I heard from his friend. I got an email, and he said, well, what happened, Sheikh Adnan had gone to visit his parents, as he does every week, and he was coming back home in his car, and he had his 10-year-old daughter with him, and they were pulled over by a car full of gunmen. And they were pulled over, and they sent the little girl home, and they said, well, we're just going to take your father. We have to ask him some questions. And so they, two of them got in the car with guns on him, and they drove him away in his car, and that's it. And that's it. And it's, you know, and basically when you look at the news coming out of Iraq every day and you see, well, the Iraqi police uncover 12 bodies in a field outside of Bakuba, or scores of bodies wash up on the beach of the Tigris River, you know, he's one of those. So they basically rarely, if ever, makes the media. No one will ever see or hear from or know what happened, and that's the situation. Most of the deaths don't get reported in the media at all. And so when we look at the overall situation with that story in mind, multiplied countless numbers of times, that's why when we have something like the report that was published in the British peer-reviewed medical journal The Lancet in October 2006, otherwise known as the Lancet report, that found 655,000 Iraqis, or 2.5% of the total population of the country, had died as a direct result of the invasion and occupation, that when that first came out, that figure shocked a lot of people. But people like me and other journalists who have spent enough time in Iraq to see the apocalyptic nature of the occupation and how violent and completely out of control it is, it wasn't that shocking, actually. And especially when me and I don't know how many of my colleagues know so many Sheikh Adnans that type of thing has happened to. So, but as incredibly high as that figure is, we have updated figures. We have a group in the U.S. called Just Foreign Policy that has taken a figure They based their figure primarily on the Lancet study and then extrapolated information from UN data, media reports, et cetera. And they've come up with a new number, and that number is significantly higher. And one of the main reasons it's significantly higher is because the legwork for that study published in the Lancet that was published October 2006, which is already over a year out of date. But another reason is because the legwork for that study took place in July 2005. So we basically have no new data on the number of dead from July 2005 until now. In between July 2005 and now, we've seen periods of some of the heaviest violence of the entire occupation. And so just foreign policy's figure is now over 1.1 million Iraqis have died. There's a similar type of organization in the UK, a polling group that did their study, and their study is actually 1.2 million dead Iraqis. And in the United States, a country with a population now a bit over 300 million people, I haven't done this in Canada, so I can't give you something a little bit more tangible, closer to home, to really try to drive this home. But in the United States, if we were going to show comparable casualties of a similar percentage, of the same percentage of people that would have died in the United States, it would mean that every person in Atlanta, Denver, Boston, Seattle, Milwaukee, Fort Worth, Baltimore, San Francisco, Dallas, and Philadelphia would be dead. Every single person. And when we consider the fact that Iraq's population when the invasion was launched in March 2003 was 27 million people, it's now around 23 million people. Because, as I said before, there's, according to the UNHCR, there's a minimum of 2.25 million people internally displaced within Iraq, refugees within their own country. There's at least another 2.25 million that have fled the country altogether. And these are very, very conservative figures. There's a minimum number of 3 million people that have been significantly wounded. And according to an Oxfam International report published this last July, 4 million Iraqis are in dire need of emergency aid. For example, 70% of the country does not have access to potable water. So the 4 million, and these are not the refugees. So the 4 million, these are people that if they don't get water, food, and medical attendance as they need it soon, they're literally at risk for their lives. So when we add all these numbers up and the number of dead, that means that over 50% of the total population of Iraq are either displaced, wounded, in need of emergency assistance, or dead. But things are getting better in Iraq if you listen to the corporate media.
We will continue with Dar Jamail, author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, in Vancouver, December 8th.
I want to read two things from the book. One I'd like to read is about a short bit of from when I went into Fallujah during the April 2004 siege. And again, to give you a bit of a taste of what it really felt like to be in Iraq, particularly in the middle of a conflict zone. And I decided to go into Fallujah because there were no reporters in the city aside from two correspondents with Al Jazeera. And the military was doing everything they could to keep journalists outside of the country. They had outside of the city. They had cordoned off the best they could. They were doing things like turning away aid convoys, turning away media vehicles. And in fact, they were trying so hard even to get the Al Jazeera correspondents out that they set up this ruse that they were going to be doing negotiations on April 9th. The siege started on April 4th. And they were so troubled by the fact that Al Jazeera was airing footage of American snipers shooting civilians, American snipers shooting ambulances, warplanes bombing civilian homes, etc. This was not helping their image across the Arab world. And so when the U.S. were trying to set up truce negotiations for April 9 with resistance fighters in the city, one of their demands was that the Al Jazeera camera crew leave the city. So on April 9, hearing about these atrocities, I had the chance to go into the city. There was an Iraqi NGO in Baghdad that had arranged for a bus carrying humanitarian supplies. And me and a British woman named Jo Wilding and David Martinez, an American independent filmmaker, and a few other folks decided to go into the city on this bus because we were just carrying in literally, we had a couple of stacks of blankets and then boxes of some basic antibiotics, things like gauze and rubber gloves. We basically flew a white flag out the window and drove the bus into the city. And we chose April 9th because according to the U.S. military, and of course then repeated by a complicit corporate media, most of the corporate media, April 9th was a ceasefire because this truce negotiation was ongoing. But when we went into the city, we were watching, I saw with my own eyes, F-16s bombing parts of the city, helicopters strafing other parts. And when we got into the clinic in the middle of the city, that's essentially the context for this next bit that I'd like to read. We rolled toward the one small clinic where we were to deliver our medical supplies. The small clinic was managed by Maki Al-Nazal, who was hired just 4 days ago. He was not a doctor. The other makeshift clinic in Fallujah was in a mechanic's garage. He had barely slept in the past week, nor had any of the doctors at the small clinic. Originally, the clinic had just three doctors, but since the U.S. military bombed one of the hospitals and were currently sniping at people as they attempted to enter or exit the main hospital, effectively there were only these two small clinics treating the entire city of 350,000 people. The boxes of medical supplies we brought into the clinic were torn open immediately by the desperate doctors. A woman entered, slapping her chest and face, and wailing as her husband carried in the dying body of her little boy. Blood was trickling off one of his arms, which dangled out of his father's arms. Thus began my witnessing of an endless stream of women and children who had been shot by U.S. soldiers and were now being raced into the dirty clinic, the cars speeding over the curb out front, and weeping family members carrying in their wounded. One 18-year-old girl had been shot through the neck. She was making breathy, gurgling noises as the doctors frantically worked on her amid her muffled moaning. Flies dodged the working hands of doctors to return to the patches of her vomit that stained her black abaya. Her younger brother, a small child of 10 with a gunshot wound in his head from a Marine sniper, his eyes glazed and staring into space, continually vomited as the doctors raced to save his life while family members cried behind me. "The Americans cut our electricity days ago, so we cannot vacuum the vomit from his throat," a furious doctor tells me. They were both loaded into an ambulance and rushed toward Baghdad, only to die en route. Another small child lay on a blood-spattered bed, also shot by a sniper. The boy's grandmother lay nearby, shot as she was attempting to carry children from their home and flee the city. She lay on a bed dying, still clutching a bloodied white surrender flag. Hundreds of families were trapped in their homes, terrorized by U.S. snipers shooting from rooftops in the minarets of mosques whenever they saw someone move past a window. Blood bags were being kept in a food refrigerator, warmed under running water before being given to patients. There were no anesthetics. The lights went out as the generator ran dry of fuel, so the doctors, who had been working for days on end, worked by light provided by men holding up cigarette lighters or flashlights as the sun set. Needless to say, there was no air conditioning inside the steamy clinic. One victim of the U.S. military aggression after another was brought in to the clinic, nearly all of them women and children, carried by weeping family members. Those who had not been hit by bombs from warplanes had been shot by U.S. snipers. The one functioning ambulance left at this clinic sat outside with bullet holes in the sides and a small group of shots right on the driver's side of the windshield. The driver, his head bandaged from being grazed by the bullet of the sniper, refused to go collect any more of the dead and wounded. Standing near the ambulance in frustration, Maki told us, "They shot the ambulance and they shot the driver after they checked his car, inspected his car, and knew that he was carrying nothing. Then they shot him, and then they shot the ambulance. And now I have no ambulance to evacuate more than 20 wounded people. I don't know who is doing this and why he is doing this. This is terrible. This has never happened before, and I don't know who to call because it seems that nobody is listening." The stream of patients slowed to a sporadic influx as night fell. Maki sat with me as we shared cigarettes in a small office in the rear of the clinic. "For all my life, I believed in American democracy," he told me with an exhausted voice. For 47 years, I had accepted the illusion of Europe and the United States being good for the world, the carriers of democracy and freedom. Now I see that it took me 47 years to wake up to the horrible truth. They are not here to bring anything like democracy or freedom. Now I see it has all been lies. The Americans don't give a damn about democracy or human rights. They are worse than even Saddam. I asked him if he minded if I quoted him with his name. What are they going to do to me that they haven't already done here? He said. Now I'd like to talk briefly about the aftermath, and I touched earlier of what happened after that. The Americans failed to take the city. As that siege continued, 736 people were killed, 60% of them civilians, according to doctors at Fallujah General. And that set the stage for the November siege, which destroyed 70% of the city. 5,000 people were killed, the vast majority of those civilians as well. And, of course, illegal weapons like white phosphorus, incendiary weapons, and cluster bombs were used heavily during the siege. To this day, the U.S. military maintains a security cordon around the city, an Israeli-style security cordon where they're using biometrics, things like retina scans and fingerprinting people with all 10 fingerprints, and giving them a barcode to establish that they're residents in the city, and severely restricting movement in and out of the city. And that's the situation today. 80% unemployment in Fallujah. Entire neighborhoods remain to this day, since the November 04 siege, without water and electricity. It's basically a ghost town. And there's been a vehicle ban, either total or partial vehicle ban, in Fallujah since this last May. And that continues to this day. I have an Iraqi colleague that I'm working with Interpress Service for. He's sending me information, and he's based in Fallujah today. So we're still getting updated information on that. And I want to talk briefly about going back to why the war happened, and basically what is generating this and what's perpetuating the occupation. When we have people like Abu Zaid coming out and talking about, well, we may well be another 50 years in the Middle East, and the leading three so-called Democratic presidential candidates in the United States, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John Edwards, all three of them theoretically opposed to the war by their party affiliation. That's kind of a joke. Have all three already come out and taken the idea of discussing immediate unconditional withdrawal of all occupation forces from the country? They've taken it off the table until after their first term, if one of them comes into power. So they won't even talk about it until 2013. So why is this? And I want to read another short bit from the book that I think illustrates it as good as anything. And on this, there are countless topics we could discuss. But I want to talk about Halliburton. And the brief context I'll give for this is it was in December 2003. And again, so we're talking 7 months into the occupation, not long. And already we have gas crises that are exacerbated by lack of electricity because there was no reconstruction happening to the benefit of the Iraqis. There was lots of reconstruction on bases, military bases, but there was no electrical infrastructure, water, medical, nothing like this happening. So one reason a gas crisis is so critical in Iraq, when you don't have electricity and then you're buying gas gasoline-powered generators to run a fan or a light at night, or maybe a refrigerator to store food, it makes living a bit more complicated and difficult. So that's why, particularly in Iraq, where gasoline, you know, you could say a lot of bad things about Saddam Hussein, but one thing you can't ever be critical of was that there was always plenty of gasoline and it was always extremely cheap, but not so under the occupation. And so that's the context for this next couple of pages I'd like to read. And it's just me and my interpreter at the time. We were walking back to our hotel. We passed a small, decrepit petrol station with two lines of cars stretching as far as we could see, waiting for gas. There was a separate line for black marketeers who were lined up with jerry cans and plastic jugs awaiting their chance. The black market was burgeoning. Those who could afford the extra cost were less willing to wait in the ever-lengthening lines as the gas crisis worsened. The black marketers took their plastic jugs to the petrol stations, filled them, walked down the street a few meters, and used siphons and plastic funnels to pour gas into the empty tanks of those able to pay a little extra. Everyone from small children to elderly men on crutches were doing this. Meanwhile, short-tempered Iraqis were jamming their cars toward the pumps, some having slept overnight in their cars in order to keep their place in line. "And the Americans try to tell us this war is not about our oil," yelled a man pushing his car. He agreed to talk with us as long as we stayed out of his way. Even under that bastard Saddam, we never had benzene shortages. I'd seen these lines all over Baghdad. Gas lines were so thick in some areas that traffic would often get choked down to a single lane, further aggravating the already impossible chaos of Baghdad's auto congestion. Some of the men we spoke with in the fuel line were aware of the fact that Halliburton subsidiary KBR had just been caught by the Pentagon for grossly overcharging them by importing gasoline into Iraq from Kuwait at $2.65 per gallon. Iraqi concerns were able to do the job for under $1 per gallon. Halliburton, which had Dick Cheney as its chairman and CEO from 1995 to 2000, before he relinquished his position in order to become vice president of the United States, was unabashedly looting the Pentagon. By this time, Cheney's old company, which he still had financial ties with and has, had obtained billions of dollars of contracts in Iraq. No one knows exactly how much money has been contracted in total, but as of the time of this writing, Halliburton's overall contracts for log cap and oil infrastructure rebuilding have totaled approximately $20 billion in Iraq. Total expenditures on U.S. corporations operating in Iraq on reconstruction and other services is about $50 billion. LogCAP is a logistics civil augmentation program with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which is Halliburton's largest government contract. Under this contract, Halliburton is responsible for providing supplies and services to the U.S. military on a global basis. Services include construction of military housing for troops, transporting food and supplies to bases, and serving food. So, pause. There's, according to the Department of Defense, there's over 736 U.S. military bases around the planet. Halliburton has the contract of supplying, doing construction on, and servicing all of those U.S. military bases around the globe. It's a pretty sweet deal. It's worth noting that it was Dick Cheney as Defense Secretary in 1992 who spearheaded the movement to privatize most of the military's civil logistics activities. Under Cheney's direction, $9 million was paid by the Pentagon to KBR to conduct a study to determine whether private companies like KBR should handle all the military civil logistics. That's in the club, too. KBR's classified study conveniently concluded that greater privatization of logistics was in the government's best interest. Big shocker. Shortly thereafter, on August 3, 1992, Secretary Cheney awarded the first comprehensive log cap contract to KBR. The Washington Post reported at the time, quote, "The Pentagon chose KBR to carry out the study and subsequently selected the company to implement its own plan." 3 years later, Cheney became CEO of Halliburton. And then to finish the linear progression, so he remained CEO of Halliburton up until 99, when George Bush announces he's going to run for president of the United States, and a committee clearly needs to be formed, as is how it goes in the United States, in order to try to decide and choose, okay, who's going to be his running mate, who's going to be his vice president. So Cheney volunteers to chair that committee, and then he chooses himself. And then literally the day before he's sworn in as vice president, he steps out of his CEO position. And then the next day he's sworn in as vice president. And here we are. I think that's pretty clear. A quick update on that, former Halliburton subsidiary KBR has received so far now contracts in Iraq totaling well over $20 billion. And a Pentagon audit of $16.2 billion worth of KBR's work found that at least $3.2 billion in KBR billing was either questionable or completely unsupported by documentation. another big shocker.
We will continue with Dar Jamail, author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, in Vancouver, December 8th.
I want to talk a little bit about why there's so much violence in Iraq, particularly coming from the U.S. military, and why U.S. soldiers have done so many of the things like the Abu Ghraibs, the Hadithas, the Fallujahs. Why is this happening? And I actually close my book. I think it's an important question because it's something that's going to be ongoing for, well, an indefinite period of time right now, and it is going to get worse in time. And I decided to, I had met a man named Robert J. Lifton. He lives in Boston. He's a famous psychiatrist because he had done studies. He became very interested in trying to figure out how is it possible for one human being to carry out atrocities on another human being. And for example, he did studies, he's done volumes of studies, but he did studies of on Hitler's SS after World War II to try to figure out how could a human being, ideology or not, how could a human being put another human being in an oven and burn them alive? How can that happen? And he wanted to figure out psychologically, how does a human being do that? How does he get to the stage of doing that? And then he did similar studies during and after the Vietnam War for the United States military. He would interview troops coming back home because it was not uncommon in the U.S. that literally, similar to Iraq, guys would be walking in the jungle on patrol one day and 2 days later be showing up at San Francisco Airport and walking around the streets of San Francisco. And it became common, especially in the latter years of Vietnam, for troops to come home. I mean, it was such an atrocity-producing situation, that's what Lifton labeled it, that they would come home and they had become so normalized to that type of situation that they would come home with necklaces of ears that they had cut off of Vietnamese resistance fighters, or carrying digits of their fingers in their pockets as war trophies and this kind of thing. And so again, Lifton tried to figure out how can people do this to other human beings? I mean, ideology or not, how can this happen? And he, a lot of his work actually ended up playing a very heavy role in updating what was formerly called shell shock into post-traumatic stress disorder. A lot of that's thanks to Robert J. Lifton. I mean, this is an individual that absolutely knows what he's talking about. And so when he saw the Hadithas and the Abu Ghraibs and things like that coming out of Iraq, he again started writing about it and researching what was happening. And so in order to not dehumanize American soldiers or try to paint them as the bad guy or something like that, I thought it was very important to include this in the book, and also because it was something that I experienced myself as well. In an article titled Conditions of Atrocity, Robert J. Lifton cited both My Lai in Vietnam, the My Lai Massacre, and the Iraqi prison scandal of Abu Ghraib as examples of what he called, and then the rest of this is his writing, atrocity-producing situations, so structured, psychologically and militarily, that ordinary people, men or women, no better or worse than you or I, can regularly commit atrocities. In Vietnam, that structure included free fire zones, areas in which soldiers were encouraged to fire at virtually anyone, body counts, with a breakdown in the distinction between combatants and civilians, and competition among commanders for the best statistics, and the emotional state of U.S. soldiers as they struggled with grief, with angry grief, over buddies killed by invisible adversaries, and with a desperate need to identify some enemy. This kind of atrocity-producing situation surely occurs in some degree in all wars, including World War II, the U.S.'s last, quote, good war. But a counterinsurgency war in a hostile setting, especially when driven by profound ideological distortions, is particularly prone to sustained atrocity, all the more so when it becomes an occupation. And I'm going to close on a little bit more of an up note, but before I do that, the open-ended question that I want to leave you with, a rhetorical question, is what's your red line? and perhaps it's already been crossed. And I'd like to close with reading a poem. As I said, it's a little bit more on an upbeat so that people don't walk out of here and slit their wrist after all of this information. But it's a poem by poet and author Marge Piercy, and it's called The Low Road. What can they do to you? Whatever they want. They can set you up. They can bust you. They can break your fingers. They can burn your brain with electricity. Blur you with drugs till you can't walk, can't remember. They can take your child, wall up your lover. They can do anything. You can't stop them from doing. How can you stop them? Alone you can fight, you can refuse, you can take what revenge you can, but they roll over you. But two people fighting back to back can cut through a mob. A snake dancing file can break a cordon. An army can meet an army. Two people can keep each other sane, can give support, conviction, love, massage, hope, sex. Three people are a delegation, a committee, a wedge. With four, you can play bridge and start an organization. With six, you can rent a whole house, eat pie for dinner with no seconds, and hold a fundraising party. A dozen make a demonstration. 100 fill a hall. 1,000 have solidarity in your own newsletter. 10,000 power in your own paper. 100,000 your own media. 10 million your own country. It goes on one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again after they said no. It starts when you say we and know who you mean. And each day you mean one more. Thank you.
That was Dar Jamil, author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, and published by Haymarket Press. The speech was recorded by Radio EcoShock on December 8, 2007, at the Planetarium in Vancouver, Canada. Find out more about the book at beyondthegreenzone.org or Google Dar Jamil, spelled DarJamil. Mr. Jamil asks you to support Iran Veterans Against the War at www.ivaw.org. This speech was sponsored by the Coalition in Solidarity with the People of Iraq, SASAPI, by StopWar.ca, and by Adala.ca, the Canadian Arab Justice Committee. You can download this speech and selections from the question and answer period from our website at ecoshock.org. Select Military from the Audio On Demand menu. I'm Alex Smith, and once again, find out how to get Dar Jamil's book at beyondthegreenzone.org. We just have time for a couple more quotes from the question and answer period at the speech.
I have really no idea of suggestions on how to support the Iraqi resistance in like a physical way. I certainly wouldn't recommend trying to send money or something like that, because it'd be a one-way ticket to Guantanamo. And we already know how immune Canadian citizens are to that. So I think just briefly, though, to talk about the Iraqi resistance is that, I mean, it sounds like we probably agree in that it's no one's position outside of Iraq, least of all people in the United States and other Western countries, to judge and determine what a resistance should look like. This invasion and occupation took place because we as Americans failed in our duty as citizens in a theoretical democracy to stop a government from launching an illegal, immoral invasion and occupation. So therefore, by default, I have no place in judging, well, okay, Kalashnikovs are okay, but car bombs are out. You know, I have no moral justification to it would allow me to judge them for what kind of resistance they're going to use against the most powerful military on the planet. But a little bit about the resistance is it's extremely complex. There isn't a resistance. There's a myriad collection of militias, of mercenaries, of nationalists, of ex-militaries. I mean, you know, there's one person responsible for at least founding the resistance, and it's Paul Bremer, the head of the Coalition Provisional Authority, who overnight disbanded the Iraqi military. So literally, in 24 hours, you had hundreds of thousands of armed, trained, angry, unemployed men on the streets. And that, to this day, forms the backbone and arguably the skeleton of the resistance. But over time, it is becoming increasingly religious and Islamist, as is the rest of the country. Because when you erase the state, and you don't, not only do you not replace it, but it is replaced with violence, death, suffering, the erasing of the culture, the erasing of the shredding of the social fabric, and no infrastructure services at all, then people turn to whatever structures left, the tribe and the mosque. And the resistance is, of course, being affected by that as well. But again, according to the U.S. military, the maximum number of people launching attacks on them that are not Iraqis is between 4 and 6%. That's according to the U.S. military. So it's a primarily Iraqi and nationalist resistance, but it is becoming more fundamentalist and more the boundaries that used to exist are definitely being blurred. But Iraq's basically being broken down into different geographic areas governed by warlords, kind of like what's happened in Afghanistan, where the U.S. is basically saying, all right, the Shia, you know, like the Fadila party, you guys got this part of Basra, the Sadrists have this part, the Badr organization, the militia of SAIC, you've got this part. So it's basically being divvied up to warlords and their militias and tribes and their militias. That's becoming really, really prominent too. Any doubters, if don't take my word for it about U.S. policy, not just in Iraq and not just in the Middle East, but for the globe. This, according to things, let me just read you a couple of quotes from two key documents that drive U.S. foreign policy. One of these is the Quadrennial Defense Review Report. And according to this document, there's a stated ability for the U.S. military to fight multiple overlapping wars, which they're doing right now, and to, quote, listen to this carefully, ensure that all major and emerging powers are integrated as constructive actors and stakeholders into the international system. That's what the military is going to be used for, and that's what it's being used for. Is that clear? That is stated U.S. policy. And then when we have things like the National Security Strategy of the United States, a key document in determining foreign policy around the globe, updated March 2006, but it was based, when Bush came into office, the Bush administration, Bush didn't do any of this, he can't even tie his own shoes, let's not be distracted by him. When Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and Pearl and all this gang came into power in 2000, they basically took the National Security Strategy and they took the Project for the New American Century, which is basically the blueprint for global domination of by the U.S. empire for this century, and they made it the National Security Strategy. You can literally find paragraphs that are nearly word for word in the National Security Strategy taken from the PNAC.
That was Dar Jamail, author of Beyond the Green Zone, recorded in Vancouver, Canada.